Hello and welcome to A History of Christian Theology. My name's Chad Kim. With me this week will be Ross Twelly. Ross is a PhD candidate at the Catholic University of America. He has also studied at St. Louis University. And I came across Ross through Twitter, and he had done an interesting tweet thread about the history of Christianity in modern-day France, which is known as Gaul. And I thought that it would be a helpful way to summarize some of the threads and the streams of thought that we've gone through in the podcast. So Ross brings a wealth of knowledge from his doctoral studies at the Catholic University. Ross was also interested in the fact that Protestants were doing sort of patristic studies, that they were interested in what the fathers had to say about scripture and about the creeds and about how to do theology. So our podcast mainly focuses on the history of Christianity in France. However, we do end with a little discussion of how Protestants and Catholics can both find a sort of shared heritage and shared history in studying the Church Fathers. So this has become something of an interest of mine, and just as a way of looking forward to future podcasts, I'm going to have Dr. Matthew Emerson, who's the director of the Center for Baptist Renewal, which is a project founded by Dr. Emerson, that's seeking to have Baptist theological life be influenced and recognize their shared heritage with the broader church and Catholic small c tradition. So look forward to that. We'll also be doing a podcast with Matthew Wilcoxon. Dr. Wilcoxon wrote a book on divine humility. So, and that is also a kind of, he's not a Baptist, but again, a sort of Protestant interested, broadly speaking, in the heritage of the church. So be looking forward to those podcasts, which should be coming in the future. Thank you for listening, and please find us on iTunes, rate us and review us on iTunes, find us on Facebook, and drop us a note on Twitter or Facebook. On Twitter, we are at TheologyXeon, that is at TheologyXeon, and then if you search for A History of Christian Theology on Facebook, our page will pop up as well. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you soon. This week on the podcast, we have Ross Twelly. Ross is a doctoral candidate at Catholic University of America. Most of this podcast started because of a tweet thread that Ross had done on Christianity in Gaul and this question of cathedral schools. And I think it was in response to a particular Saints Day was actually what started it, and this question of Poitiers, so where Hilary of Poitiers is the town that he is associated with. And it just made me think that we hadn't done a lot on Christianity in France, which is also Gaul. I thought, hey, this would be fun for a different kind of conversation. Also, I've been working on some stuff that Hilary of Poitiers had written on the Psalms. And so I was like, oh, this will be fun. And I'll learn some more from Ross about this. And it'll help us just sort of, and I think one angle the podcast had maybe been going towards was talking a little bit about the history of Christianity in different places. So we talked a little bit about Christianity in Africa. We've done some podcasts on Christianity in like Syriac Christianity, early sort of Asian Christianity. And so now we're going to do a little bit of Gaul. And so Ross has some expertise in this area. You could tell me your dissertation is maybe not so much focused on Hilary of Poitiers, although you, as I understand, really enjoy reading him. But what is your dissertation itself actually on?
Yeah, that is all true. And actually, on the side, I'm trying to work through Hilary's Psalms commentaries as well.
Okay.
Which is, you know, about 800 pages of Latin. So that's, yeah. And it's Hilary's Latin, which is a slow go in the first place. But yeah, strictly speaking, my dissertation is on the decade that Hilary spends when he first becomes Bishop of Poitiers and then when he is sent into exile. So that's the decade of the 350s. It's right smack dab in the middle of the beginning of the Arian controversy with Arius himself and the final resolution of it in the 380s under Theodosius and Ambrose. It's a time when the emperor, one of the emperors in between, Constantine's son Constantius, is trying to enforce one specific kind of formulation of the creed across the Roman Empire, which many of the bishops that whose writings we still have from the Latin West consider to be a light form of Arianism, because it tries to forbid anyone from using substance language to describe any of the persons of God at all, because it's not a scriptural term. So I'm looking at three or four bishop theologians from that decade who are responding to this movement, and it includes the very beginning of Hilary's career, but it does not include most of his De Trinitate or the Psalm commentaries that he wrote after he came back from exile.
Okay, very good. And so what part of what's interesting about studying this period, the kind of late fourth century, as you bring out some of this stuff that we've been talking about online, but is also just this that there's a lot of conversations. It wasn't just as simple as here's the creed, everybody agrees, let's move forward. There's back and forth, there's pushback, there's a lot of writing, and it's a very and also part of what makes Hilary so fascinating is the overlap between the East and the West. So Hilary in exile is spending a lot of time in Constantinople and other places, getting to know what kind of theological conversations are being had in the Greek East. And so then he's able to bring some of that back to the Latin West. And so there's a little bit of overlap, and we could say cross-pollination between these two different areas. I think, you know, sometimes like Athanasius is contra mundum. So we've done a little bit of Athanasius on this podcast, but he's, you know, often regarded, including by C.S. Lewis, as this champion of orthodoxy and the Nicene Creed, and some have seen Hilary as maybe a little bit of a lesser form, less well known, but similar kind of proponent of the Nicene Creed. But even that has to be nuanced a little bit because of his influence of Basil of Ancyra and some of the other theologians that he was actually talking about.
I think we actually underestimate how much East-West contact Hilary brings with him back from exile.
Okay.
I think most people will think of Ambrose as the first one who really brings Greek thought into Latin theological language. And in a Platonist sense, that's definitely true. I don't know that we're quite ready to call Hilary in exile a Platonist when he comes back. But he certainly brings a lot of Origen's style of biblical commentary with him. And that, I think, in some ways paves the way for the kind of commentary and the kind of treatises that Ambrose writes to get traction in the 370s and 380s, because it's not totally new to some of that Latin West audience.
I see. Yeah. And of course, for me, I did my dissertation on Augustine. So all of this is, again, more paving the way for him, so that this is not so foreign, that he can be engaged in this and be wowed by Ambrose, who, and also, you know, he mentions Hilary as well. Hilary is not unknown to Augustine. So this is part of his kind of theological education. So I'm going to turn to, so I sent to Ross just a few questions. So we've been talking about the fourth century. We've been talking about how Greek thought in this kind of later period of Christian history, you know, what the theological conversations were. But I wanted to go back, and this is mostly why I wanted Ross on here, was to help us think through a little bit the how Christianity came to Gaul, came to France. Gallia is the Latin word for France, or at least that's the way that the Romans referred to this province, Caesar's Gallic War and these sorts of things, right? So so when we say Gaul, we do mean, generally speaking, broadly speaking, roughly speaking, this area that's similar to modern day France. And we talked about Irenaeus many moons ago on the podcast, but so he's Irenaeus of Lyon. So he's from a city in France, And he may be one of the first well-known figures in modern-day France, in France, in Gaul. So I asked Ross if he'd give us a little bit of a history of how Christianity originally came to France and how people like Irenaeus came to be so influential, and then also that plays into this sort of, there was another. We have a few letters about these some martyrdoms in the area that we think was probably written by Irenaeus. So there's some martyrdom to be considered in the area, and then Irenaeus. But then there's kind of a silence, and then we've been talking about Hilary as we got started. But I kind of wanted to see, how does this process happen? Ross, I'll turn that over to you. What can you tell us about Christianity's origins in France?
So we've got two very separate and very distinct in the origins of the sources that they use to put their narrative together. Two very different accounts of what Christianity looks like in Gaul before the time of Constantine. We've mentioned Eusebius already. He is aware that there is a Christian community along the Rhone River, which flows into the Mediterranean at Marseille, in the 170s and into the early 200s, the 200-aughts, I guess, that first decade, centered on Irenaeus and his predecessor at Lyon, Pothinus.
Okay.
He has received a letter, at least the East has received a letter from Irenaeus about the martyrdom that happened there in the year 177. In case your listeners need reminding, Irenaeus is originally from West Central Asia Minor, the province of Phrygia, and we have no idea how it comes to be that he transfers to southern France of all places and becomes a presbyter in that community. But we do know that he is promoted to bishop after Pothinus is martyred in 177. We've got this letter, which we presume to be by Irenaeus himself, telling about how in the 170s, the local administration in that province of Gaul had banned Christians from any overt, open gatherings in the baths, in the markets, and also in homes. If it were known that people were going to a home for Sunday service, that would be reason enough for the local government to step in and break it up. Irenaeus seems to suggest, or at least Eusebius seems to suggest through the Irenaeus letter, that Marcus Aurelius's co-emperor Verus was behind this, that he had some sort of persecuting policy at the time. Unfortunately, Verus is dead 8 years before this particular martyrdom event actually happens, so we know that's not true. And we know that Marcus Aurelius is not in the business of ordering persecutions. He's most likely following the example set by Trajan, mm-hmm. where if someone reports a Christian sect, congregation, and it turns out that they admit to being Christians, then you have to punish them. But don't go seeking them out. So Christians are banned from these public gatherings, and probably the local government was induced to make this decision by unrest among the populace, the pagan majority populace in Vienne and Lyon, because immediately mass gatherings, Irenaeus calls them mobs, start gathering up the Christians that they personally know and beating them, stoning them in the public squares. The military tribune for that province steps in, cooperates with the city council, rounds up Christians, brings them into the forum of Lyon to be questioned. As usual, and Tertullian talks about this as well, they are accused of what Irenaeus calls Thyestean banquets and Oedipodian intercourse, which are Greek mythological references to child cannibalism and incest. And on these charges, the Christians are imprisoned until the provincial governor, whose identity we do not know for the year 177, arrives. And under the direction of the devil, of course, is equally intent on torturing these Christians and ultimately brings them into the town amphitheater to be publicly whipped, tortured with other sorts of instruments, mauled by wild beasts. At least one female Christian is tied to a stake, not to be burned, but to be mauled. And then when that fails to kill her, she's tied up in a fishnet bag and left in front of a starved and wild bull to have its way with her. We know that the deacon of the city of Vienne, whose name was Sanctus, was a martyr during this, and then Lyon's bishop, Pothinus. Vienne may not, strictly speaking, have had a bishop at this time. The deacon may have been a sort of mission representative from Lyon, because it's just a little bit upriver for that community. Irenaeus also says then that the bodies of the Christians were withheld from their families and friends. They were denied burial. They were left to rot for a week and then burned, and the ashes were dumped into the Rhone, so that any claims that the Christians might make about the resurrection of their bodies would be stymied. So that's the Eusebius story. And that in the 170s, there is a well-established Christian community that then goes on for another 25 years under the illustrious and learned episcopate of Irenaeus, who also gets involved in the debates over the date of Easter and so on. The Roman story, which is recorded in the Book of the Pontiffs, the history of the popes that's put together mostly in Gaul and for Gaul, but in the 7th and 8th centuries, is that there was not a serious attempt to evangelize Gaul until the year 250, in the midst of what truly was an empire-wide persecution by the Emperor Decius, in which Pope Fabian sends missionaries to 7 cities across the Gauls, Arles, Narbonne, Toulouse, Clermont, Limoges, Tours, and Paris. So 4 of them along the southern and western coasts, and then 3 inland. And then each local diocese keeps its list of successors from those bishops, which sometimes we use that local diocesan source. Sometimes Gregory of Tours, the famous historian of Christianity in Gaul, has collected them and lists them in his writings. But there are no contemporary late 3rd century, early 4th century witnesses to any of those early successions of bishops until we get to Constantine's rule in the West, when he is approached to adjudicate the Donatist schism in Carthage and summons some Gallican bishops to look at the evidence on both sides and make a decision. And then we actually start getting lists of bishops who participate in these synods. And we end up with a list of 18 known dioceses, episcopal sees, by 360, by the end of the decade that I particularly focus on. 13 by the 310s, and then another 5 that we know exist by the 350s. That doesn't mean, of course, that each was founded in the 310s or the 350s. It just means that the earliest record we have of a named bishop being there comes from those decades. And then over the rest of the 4th century, there's just a logarithmic expansion of known bishops in the Gauls. That's partially because Gaul seems to have a unique practice of appointing an episkopos, someone with the title of bishop, for every individual congregation, not putting together provincial arrangements as, say, the bishops of Italy do. So there's just, there are more bishops in Gaul because there are, every community has one. They don't just have a presbyter or a deacon leading their community, but making reference to some metropolitan city.
So that seems, and I think I mentioned this earlier, but that's somewhat similar to what happens in North Africa, at least according to the numbers for Augustine in the early 5th century, as he is trying to settle the Donatus problem. So this is 100 years later than what you were referencing with Constantine, but the Donatus problem is still quite prevalent in Augustine's period. But he'll mention, I think the number that he gives is 286, the number of bishops in North Africa. And so it seems much more likely that if there were that many bishops, probably what they meant was, you know, head of a church rather than head of a diocese or head of a larger area, which is, you know, if you hear a Catholic person talk about bishop in the modern day, that's usually what they mean, someone who's the head of a few different churches of a larger span of space. But maybe in these early communities in Gaul and in North Africa, it was sort of a lesser title almost, but more like, almost more like head pastor of the church rather than necessarily the head of a whole bunch of churches, which is usually what is meant. And it's also possible that Augustine and the North African Christians, that one of the ways that they try to settle the Donatist debate is by saying who has more bishops. And so some people think, maybe this isn't a very fairly counted number, but.
Yeah, it's not until you have emperors who are sympathetic to Christianity, personally sympathetic to Christianity, like Constantine obviously was, that bishops can really start to make use of the secular way that the Roman world is organized into provinces and vicariates, and start to organize themselves along that model. And when Constantine allows bishops to take on secular judicial, administrative, public works kinds of duties within their provinces, within the empire. Irenaeus, he seems to be very unique in that he was so learned and such an extensive writer and had connections back to the Greek East where he was sending his writings out there, that his reputation stands as high as it does in the broader scheme of Western Christian history.
Yeah. Well, it's also just sort of interesting, again, trying to like take a step back and have kind of a big vision here. Over the course of the podcast, we have episodes about like Christianity in Alexandria. We did some episodes about the martyrdom of Perpetua and Felicitas, which is a little bit later, but fairly close to the martyrdoms of Lyon and Vienne, the ones that we think were the stories we think were told by Irenaeus. Martyrdoms and some persecutions that are around the same period, but also a lot of gaps. We don't exactly know, okay, how did this Christian community appear in Carthage? And how are there, you know, obviously there were enough structures that there were deacons and there were presbyters and they were gathering to learn the faith and some sort of catechumenate. And, you know, there was at least enough structure for this to go on, but we don't really have a lot of evidence for how that became so strong in that period. And so kind of what you're telling us a little bit about is how this happened in France. So, Irenaeus is, we're talking the late 2nd century, so 150 some odd years after the death of Christ. And then there's this period where, and well, even Irenaeus is kind of interesting. Again, we talked about this momentarily in the podcast, but he at least says that he has heard Polycarp preach And Polycarp has a connection to John. And so some of these people, we can tell a little bit of a story that does go back to Christ. But how is it that, Irenaeus, it goes so far west from across the Mediterranean, makes this kind of just an interesting moment. And to think about what it means for historians to talk about, you know, the period in between, like, you know, a lot of us want to know the early church. A lot of us want to know about the Bible, but it's also, you know, really necessary to know how the story continues. So what goes on in between the Creed of Nicaea, the Council of Nicaea, and the Creed, the Niceno-Constantinopolitan Creed, and, you know, these sorts of things. Pretty interesting. You gave us you've kind of told us, one of my questions was about what the persecutions looked like, and you gave us a little bit of that information already. So I may jump down. Okay, so we've been talking about Irenaeus, and then we talked about who told his story. So you told us Gregory of Tours, and we talked about Eusebius. So these are the sources that we have. Okay, I want to move on to another figure who we haven't talked about at all, and get a little bit more into Hilary of Poitiers. In the timeline of events, there was this persecution, there was this great figure Irenaeus, and then there was kind of a little bit of a re-evangelization almost in the mid third century, and then we have Hilary is there. So could you give us this is like closer to question number three, but I said, could we say that the persecutions were successful? Could we say that the Romans who tried to push down the Gauls, there was a little bit of a time of lapse of Christianity? Did it work? Did the persecutions work in Gaul?
I'm going to take a quick break from our podcast to tell you a little bit about our sponsor, The Upper Room.
There are some daily comforts that just make you grateful and feel more grounded in life. Petting the dog, hitting that snooze button, and of course, that first cup of coffee. These are things that you count on every day to help you get where you want to go. Things like the Upper Room Daily Devotional Guide. You can count on the Upper Room for daily inspiration, daily community, and daily prayer. It is the only daily devotional magazine written by readers, ordinary people, people who have encountered God in daily situations. The Upper Room is here for you every day through your email, a custom app, or a printed magazine. Enjoy a free 30-day trial of our email or app service by visiting theupperroom.org/welcome. That is upperroom.org/welcome, upperroom.org/welcome, to get your first 30 days free. It is interdenominational and written by readers, and it has 80 years of history and 5 million readers around the world. So this is a well-established organization. So I encourage you to go check them out and get their emails and devotional guides from their website.
It seems like no. If we're talking about the great persecution begun by Diocletian and his fellow members of the Tetrarchy, it seems pretty clear that Constantius, who was an emperor, his provinces were Britain and Gaul under the Tetrarchic system, had no stomach for instigating persecutions there, doing only the bare minimum when Christian communities were just too vocally against pagan existence in the empire, even, to be ignored. And in fact, the reason why, at the beginning of the Donatist Schism, they appeal specifically to the bishops of Gaul and not to the bishops of Italy to adjudicate for them is because there was persecution in Italy under Maximian, and there were many bishops, including some bishops of Rome, who may have been tainted by threats or accusations of being traditores, of having handed over scriptural texts or sacred vessels to the Roman authorities. Whereas in Gaul, that had pretty much not happened. because Constantius had no stomach for it, and Constantine was from the beginning apparently quite sympathetic to the Christian cause, even before he had his vision in the sky. And potentially also because his the teacher he hired for his son Crispus was Lactantius, who was an African native originally. So they may have thought that there was extra sympathy between Gaul and Africa to be had there. What I think we've got is a bunch of congregations, particularly in the coastal regions in the south and west of France now, that puttered along without any real institutional bureaucratic arrangement amongst themselves. They each had, as you said, a lead pastor, an overseer, a bishop in that sense. But it's not until the rise of Constantine and the rise of the Donatist schism that there are reasons for them to come together and start to network. They are not represented at Nicaea. As far as we know, no bishops from Gaul travel there. They are not represented at the next big Western Synod, which is at Sardica in the Balkans in the 343. There are only two bishops from Gaul represented there. So they seem to be minding their own business. And in fact, at the beginning of Hilary's exile, which begins in 356, he claims that he had never even heard the Nicene Creed before one of his fellow bishops tried to advance it as an alternative to this this white paper creed that the Emperor Constantius was trying to get approved, as I mentioned earlier. It seems like each diocese was just using whatever creed was common for their baptism liturgies at Easter time, and that's just what they had. Hilary, who is raised to the title of bishop in 350 in the city of Poitiers, which is in Aquitania, and is potentially the first bishop Poitiers ever had. In that first period, we know that he is doing some writing. He's writing a commentary on Matthew. But he doesn't become a major player until he is exiled to, conveniently enough, Phrygia, the same place that Irenaeus came from, where he starts to travel around the Greek East, meet the leading theological lights of the day there, and then start to write back to his brother bishops in the West. And he insists that he is still their brother bishop. He was exiled, but never deposed. So he considers himself very much still one of their number, one of their community. Writing back to them what is going on in the East, and how it relates to the theological positions on the relationship between God the Father and God the Son that they hold in Gaul. And when he comes back from exile, when Constantius is distracted by a war in Persia, and Hilary takes that chance to sort of sneak back home, which anyone who's familiar with Athanasius's story will not be surprised by that sort of thing. That's when he writes Old Testament commentaries. He writes Psalm commentaries. So between the stuff he writes in exile, which includes his De Trinitate, and the stuff he writes when he gets back, he seems to bring with him a spirit of institutional leadership, a spirit of really setting the agenda of theological conversation, exegetical conversation for the rest of his province that had not existed in Gaul before then.
I was just going to say, you were talking about like the Gallic churches kind of minding their own business, and how Hilary probably only knew the baptismal creeds of sort of whatever was in use before Nicaea. And I was just thinking the idea of a universal church and sort of like looking at ways in which there was overlap between the churches in the East and the churches in the West. And you're saying Hilary kind of brought some of that bigger vision back with him. It just is a, it's kind of like on the one hand, like Augustine wants to think of himself as part of the universal church. That's a big part of his theological work. But even that like is a little bit of a, you know, he has to fight for that. The Donatists kind of sounded a little bit like the Gauls. Like the Donatists seem to have wanted to be a little more to themselves and not so worried about what was going on outside of them. And I don't know, it's sort of, I had never really thought about that fact, that being maybe a common phenomena, that a lot of these little churches were less concerned with what overlap there was. And maybe Hillary being at least at the vanguard. I mean, he has a predecessor in Irenaeus who has worked across, but still there being a large gap in time. You have a sort of an interesting. Just reiterates your point that you also brought up, which is the influence of Origen and Greek thought in the West, predating Ambrose and Augustine, and really having a kind of a beginning with Hillary.
And I think it might be worth noting too that sure, Eusebius of Caesarea has a concept of the universal church that's baked into the cake of his church history, but that's not put into Latin until the 390s. Yeah. So obviously Italy has a sense of that because the bishop in Rome has been a reference point for quite a while by then for the Greek East, but no reason to think that the Gauls would.
Yeah. Yeah. That's helpful. Interesting. Well, one thing that I've been kind of like, so at SLU, we do work a lot on the interpretive schools of Alexandria and Antioch. And that's a big, Peter Martins has taught us to be very suspicious of those labels and trying to connect people and, you know, how facile they can be and this sort of thing. But I, you know, there, one of the things that you said in your tweet, you used the phrase cathedral school. Was there a cathedral school at Poitiers? And I know that these are separate concepts, but you could forgive me for being mistaken straight away if I think, okay, they're calling these cathedral schools. What, you know, I was just trying to think of like other names for things that we could call. And part of what Peter Martins has us question is really how much overlap there, or how much like direct connection there was in like a school of Antioch, rather than really what people are identifying are what they take to be patterns, rather than necessarily a direct connection. So I heard cathedral school and I was like, oh no, that's a separate thing. But could you tell us a little bit more about like what is a cathedral school exactly? And why might people think that there was a cathedral school at Poitiers? And why is that not actually really a fair way to assess what was going on at Poitiers under Hillary?
At least in Gaul and Western Germany, in the time leading up to and including Charlemagne, but in the time of the Merovingians, that first Frankish dynasty that fills the void there after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire. So the late 400s up to about 800. Cathedral schools, as far as we know them, and by then, bishops are institutionalized. The church that they govern is the cathedral of the area. Those schools seem mostly to just be training schools for aspiring clerics. They are taught a rudimentary amount of the liberal arts, enough to be able to read and interpret the scriptures the way the fathers would. And then they are trained in reading and interpreting the scriptures the way the fathers would. They're trained in preaching. They are trained in missionary work to the barbarians. They are trained in a Benedictine semi-monastic manner of life, as much as that can be put into secular use. And so they would not be all that different from the monastery schools, except that, you know, the particular content of their training of life might be more or less rigorous based on that setting. It's conceivable, though this is probably more done both at the monastic level and at the sort of individual parish level, that the cathedral schools also served some catechumenal purpose, that the master there or one of the leading pupils there might go out and help instruct the catechumens being brought into the Christian church during Lent. And to that extent, there would be a connection between the early school in Alexandria that supposedly existed as early as the 190s, which Origen is said to have been the head of, the sort of provost of it, and maybe at the end of his life, Clement of Alexandria was before him. That was primarily a catechumenal school. It too may have done some clerical formation. Certainly the bishop of that time in Alexandria, Demetrius, was a very centralizing bishop and would have been interested in seeing that happen. And in both cases, Gaul and Alexandria, the sort of central reference point would have been the master himself, who would have a sort of charismatic appeal, a sort of charismatic authority by virtue of being a good model of biblical interpretation, being a good model of Christian life, that made him worthy to train others in that. And certainly in the Gauls, that sort of personal modeling of sanctity would be more important in the clerical formation than the strict content of their intellectual education. If we're getting into, you know, the schools of biblical interpretation, talking about Alexandria versus Antioch in that sense, that's not necessarily even strictly connected to this catechetical school that I've been mentioning. Those trends in interpretation, while Origen is a reference point, as he can't not be in the Greek East, it's really the generations following Athanasius, like Patriarch Theophilus and Patriarch Cyril, whose exegetical approaches define the Alexandrian school the way we used to and still sometimes describe it. And then similarly in Antioch, Didymus the Blind is a mid fourth century exegete. So even there, there's not a very strong connection. It may be, we have no way of knowing this for sure because we don't have the curricula of the cathedral schools in Gaul, that Hilary's commentaries were part of that that curriculum, that way of interpreting. We know he had a predecessor in, not in Poitiers, in the Gauls. There's a Reticius of Autun who wrote a commentary on the Song of Songs. And then after Hilary, we know that Augustine's sermons and commentaries make their way to Gaul very early on across the Mediterranean, to the extent that some bishops whose sermon collections we possess and now recognize had their sermons wrongly identified as being Augustine sermons and included in his collections because they were mostly just copying the main content of his sermon for a particular scripture passage and then lightly adapting it for their own congregation. So it becomes a very Augustinian educational method and Benedictine life training there.
Yeah, I mean, it is, again, I just can't, trying to think of these schools and things, it's sort of funny. One of the things when I review a lot of literature on Augustine, and one of the things that sometimes people will compare, like I was just reading a book where they were talking about the monastic life of Basil of Caesarea and how influential that was in his theology. But Augustine is not looked upon as a monk or a pastor almost ever. He's just the theologian, like, or he's just the writer of the great treatises. And I was like, well, wait a minute. I mean, he considered himself some kind of a in a monastic life. And he was like, and he has people who are influential, who maybe not as influential, but Prosper of Aquitaine or Orosius or Posidius. There are people, there's a little school that's built up around Hippo. We know that he was doing some kind of training. We also know that he did it poorly, at least in the case of Antoninus. It's not always like he's doing great things, but you know a lot of these things could be said about Augustine just as well. And he thought of, you know, I don't know, it's just interesting how we have to characterize these different people to try to show what makes them sort of worth studying or influential or something like that. And Augustine just gets. He should. I mean, the Confessions of the City of God and De Turne Trate and whatever are wonderful. It really, one of the fun things about studying him in depth was what was going on in his day-to-day life. Like, he spent a lot of time trying to help pastors and help them learn how to read scripture. And, you know, some of the things that you're describing of a cathedral school, there's some similarities in even what he was trying to do in Hippo. But I digress on that.
We know that deacons from Carthage who are in charge of catechumenal formation there are writing to him for advice. Mm-hmm. And he's sending very long letters of interpretation back to them for them to use as well.
Yeah. Well, one thing I mentioned that we just recently did a podcast on Ambrose, and I had my friend Drew talk about Ambrose a little bit, and he did his PhD on Ambrose at Marquette. But we talked a little bit about his on the duties of the clergy. And I was thinking like, oh, yeah, no, this would have been a great thing. And it appears that was even in use in a lot of these cathedral schools. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, as far as we know, there wasn't another Latin father who tried to really systematize what a bishop does, what a pastor does in the nitty gritty of day-to-day engagement with parishioners. I mean, Gregory the Great, obviously, mm-hmm. the pastoral rule that he writes, gets into circulation in the early 600s. But as far as we can tell, even in the cathedral school at Paris, or at Aix, under Charlemagne, it's Ambrose's On the Duties of Clergy that is being used, that Alcuin of York is modifying for a new imperial situation up there. Yeah.
I was trying to think of other texts. So I loved reading the Gregory the Great's Pastoral Rule when I was in doing my some of the early work coursework in my PhD program. So you have that, you have On the Duties of the Clergy, and then Chrysostom has a book on the priesthood, but I don't know when or if that was translated into Latin. So, you know, but I was just trying to think of other texts that could be used, and you could, like, it could sort of be an interesting kind of lateral comparative study of different ways in which clergy are trained in the 4th, 5th, 6th centuries or something. You know, what did they use? What did they do? How did that go? I guess Cassiodorus even a little bit in the Divine and Secular Learning, although not specific. I mean, it of course is clerical that he has somewhere in mind, but it may be broader as well. It's not directly like how do you administer a parish or whatever, but has.
And Cassiodorus does a lot of his writing after he moves east.
Yeah.
To escape the Gothic Arian court.
Yeah.
So it's unclear even how much of that makes its way back home.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. Interesting. A lot to think about. Well, we are running out of time. And one thing that you mentioned to me that was sort of that you enjoyed about the podcast or sort of made you curious about the podcast was specifically Protestant interest in the patristic period. That was somewhat peculiar to you, or at least like you didn't, maybe knew that it was happening, but it was interesting to listen to Protestants have conversations about it because you know, from a from a Roman Catholic standpoint, of course, this stuff is important. Even if, as you pointed out, the way that the average Roman Catholic, what they know about the Church Fathers differs from what like we might do in a doctoral seminar, or the kind of like research that we're doing is very specific historical. It's not even necessarily the exact sort of thing that may happen on a weekly basis in the parish. What kind of things surprised you about Protestant interest in the Church Fathers? Is there any kind of response that you'd like to give to what that's been like as a Catholic listening to Protestants sort of look through the Church Fathers for some sort of ressourcement or inspiration or something?
Well, I certainly am glad that it's happening. Uh-huh. That sort of shared heritage that we all have well before even the Orthodox split, much less any of the Protestant splits, that is at least in some circles coming back into interest in Protestantism is welcome. I think we're all probably in the same boat that the average member of a congregation doesn't know much personally about the Fathers, except that Augustine is a big one. And that Athanasius is a name you should know. And that there are a lot of them named Gregory. When you do at least get Catholics who know something about the Fathers, it's usually one of two ways. Either they use the Catholic prayer book called the Liturgy of the Hours, which is a set of psalm readings and scripture readings for various times of the day, and has one early morning hour that includes a reading from one of the patristic fathers or medieval scholastic masters, and sometimes later in 20th century Vatican texts as well. And they will recognize some names and at least the spirit of that kind of writing from that. Or they will have done a deep dive into ways that Protestants are wrong about the Eucharist, or wrong about what baptism does, or wrong about Mary and saints and popes and things. And they will have gone back and done their proof texting in the Fathers to see how to prove the antiquity of these beliefs and the rightness of these beliefs. And I occasionally in my own research, I have found like, a late 19th century Anglican cleric use Irenaeus to try to prove that he didn't have a Eucharistic theology, stuff like that. But I don't know personally whether that has also been a Protestant scholarly approach in the past century or two to go back to the Fathers and say, well, see, Catholics, they didn't actually think what you thought they think. you'd have to enlighten me on that.
Yeah. So one person that I know, there was a book by a Southern Baptist guy at the undergrad that I went to, a Southern Baptist school, Oklahoma Baptist University, and he just did something with InterVarsity Press on the Descent to the Dead. He did some sort of ressourcement kind of things, trying to like look for the Fathers for why, where this came from. It was not specifically used as a polemic though. It was more just what usually happens for Protestants who, like myself, who are interested in the Church Fathers, is usually not trying to to make it an attack on a belief, but really is just trying to show, like, you know, I've probably made this joke on the podcast before, but the way that I was raised, you know, we just sort of assumed that church history went Jesus, Billy Graham, and my pastor. And then I went to high school with Presbyterians, and they were like, oh, we study history. Well, what does that mean for them? Well, that means we study Jesus, Martin Luther, John Calvin, and then up to the present day. So, but no one wants to talk about, well, what about Aquinas? You know, and maybe a Presbyterian says, I know that Augustine's important. But let's say anything in between Augustine and Luther just sort of seemed to be glossed over and overlooked and really not part of our shared heritage, as you say. So I think probably the spirit in which I and a lot of other contemporary Protestants are looking at the Church Fathers is to sort of say, like, yeah, this is our shared tradition. So, like, you know, like, it's not just trying to look for how we can prove the other wrong as much as what we can learn. Like, I mean, I think if a lot of contemporary pastors read Gregory the Great's Pastoral Rule, we'd be a lot better off. If there was like that sort of spirit of how to lead people and train people and, you know, have prayerful life, you know, the way that he models it. So, you know, I guess I look at it as, you know, how can I look at this as part of what makes Protestant Protestants? Even if there's a rejection of some of the way that it's used or something, it's still part of our, it's part of who we are. So Calvin's commentaries, I mean, he writes a commentary on every book of the Bible. And in nearly every book, he cites various church fathers, not just Augustine. And actually, usually, it's more favorably Cyril of Alexandria or St. John Chrysostom. Or, you know, he's actually much more amenable in the biblical commentaries to some other church fathers, especially Chrysostom, but than even Augustine, which would surprise some people. Because he seems to be, you know, Augustine seems to be his champion. Anyway, we can lay that to the side. It's fun to, you know, it's cool that, it's cool that this can be a shared way, like way of investigation. And like I say, I mean, for me, I hope it's always a, you know, I'm learning how to, I'm learning about God through these men. For me, this is always like, and women, I should say, men and women. I'm looking for ways in which the broader tradition has thought about the overlap between revelation of the scriptures and Jesus Christ, and, you know, and how that we can use that as a way to have a shared vision of God, you know, ultimately. So that's my sort of hope for it, even if it's a little bit more scholarly at times.
We had a period in the 80s, maybe early 90s, when Pope John Paul II released an instruction to colleges and seminaries asking them not so much to back off the Aquinas, but to rediscover the Fathers. Uh-huh. And to look to them as a model of understanding scripture in a way much closer to the way its authors understood it as they were writing it, to developing a habit of Christocentricity, putting the lordship of Jesus at the center, reading the whole of scripture as an organic whole where the two shed light on each other, Old Testament and New. And following that, we had quite an academic Catholic revival looking at the spirit of the Fathers and what it means to think patristically.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of that has gotten into the seminaries exactly, but at least in the sort of Jesuit academic world and other diocesan and religious run universities, it's been good.
Yeah.
It's been positive.
Well, I really appreciate it, and I'm going to have to run to teach some Latin here in about 30 minutes, so I need to get on my tie and get over to SLU. I really have appreciated talking to you, and hopefully we can do this again and maybe do a deeper dive into some of the stuff that you're doing, you know, whatever you've been working on in the meantime, maybe, you know, figuring out what Hillary is up to in his Psalms commentaries or something.
I'd love that. Thanks.
Very good. Well, thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. And I will hopefully we can talk soon.
Thank you for listening to History of Christian Theology. My name is Chad Kim. And we will be back next week with some more interviews and probably a podcast or two with Tom and Trevor as well. Be well.